Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, infographics, relevant links, book suggestions, or just to leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is November 5th, and I'm very pleased to welcome Laurette Lynn back to the show. You remember Laurette Lynn. She used to do a radio show called Unplug Mom. You can currently find all of her work at laurettelynn.com. Laurette first appeared on the show in episode 87, Unplugging and Activating, a show for parents. And her most recent appearance was in May of 2013 in an episode entitled Home Trivium Roundtable. So it's great to have Laurette back on the show. Today's discussion is about how parents and educators can improve communication and connection with young people. Part of this production focuses on how destructive communication can negatively impact personal growth. We'll also answer questions like, how do teens respond to condescension? How do young people respond to praise? We explore this phenomenon of teenage rebellion and talk a little bit about why it happens. We also try to extract the essential attributes of the practice, usually covered by the phrase peaceful parenting. Laurette raises some objections with that term that are interesting, and we discuss that as well. I also just want to add, right after Laurette and I plan to have this conversation, I listened to an episode of Kevin Geary's show, Reboot Your Kids. Wes was the guest, and the title of the episode was How You Talk to Your Child Becomes Their Inner Voice. And this is highly recommended listening if you're interested in exploring this topic further. I did take a lot of notes listening to that episode, knowing that I was going to have a conversation with Laurette about communication. Unfortunately, we didn't get to most of them, so we might do that in an upcoming show. I think this is a really, really important topic. It ties back to the series that we did this summer, Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience, where we talked about internal family systems therapy. And if you missed those episodes, just in a very quick nutshell, internal family systems therapy is a practice where somebody who is interested in either healing psychological wounds goes through a process of identification within their own personality, recognizing that each one of our personalities is composed of distinct parts. And even though some of those parts seem to manifest in destructive ways, each part was formed in an effort to protect the entire self system. Internal family systems therapy is a practice of acknowledging all of those parts, hearing all of those parts, not trying to exile them or send them to their rooms. They won't stay there. And the goal, through the acknowledgement and the listening to each part, is ultimately to put it into constructive use in the entire self system through a process of self leadership. Some great resources for internal family systems therapy we've talked about on the show before: The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. He deals with IFS in the later chapters. Pete Gerlach, who unfortunately passed away recently, I used some audio clips of him in the ACES series as well. He has a YouTube channel. His last name is spelled G-E-R-L-A-C-H, and I will put a link to his free online course in the show notes. One of the challenging parts of personality that Kevin and Wes discuss in that show is the inner critic, what in IFS might be referred to as a manager. There's another psychologist, his name is Jay Early. He identified 7 types of inner critic. And I just wanted to go through those relatively quickly here as a kind of interactive exercise, something for us to think about. I think in the future, this will be an entire production, a really, really, really important concept. I would love to hear from somebody who doesn't believe that they have one of these types or more than one of these types of inner critic. And if people have experience with IFS, I would also like to hear how that critic was heard and how that critic was integrated into the whole self in a constructive way. There's another great resource. It's called personalgrowthprograms.com. The website is hyphenated, so personal-growth-programs.com, with a lot of good resources on the inner critic concept. So J. Early's seven types of inner critic are as follows. The first one is the perfectionist. This critic tries to get you to do things perfectly. It sets high standards for the things you produce and has difficulty saying something is complete and letting it go out to represent your best work. It tries to make sure that you fit in and that you will not be judged or rejected. Its expectations probably reflect those of the people who have been important to you in the past. The guilt tripper is the second one. This critic is stuck in the past and is unable to forgive you for wrongs you have done or people you have hurt. It is concerned about relationships and holds you to standards of behavior prescribed by your community, culture, and family. And it tries to protect you from repeating past mistakes by making sure you never forget or feel free. Third type, the underminer. This critic tries to undermine your self-confidence and self-esteem so you won't take risks. It makes direct attacks on your self-worth so you will stay small and not take chances where you could be hurt or rejected. It is afraid of your being too big or too visible and not being able to tolerate judgment or failure. The destroyer. It makes pervasive attacks on your fundamental self-worth. It shames you and makes you feel inherently flawed or not entitled to basic understanding or respect. This most debilitating critic comes from early life deprivation or trauma. It is motivated by a belief that it is safer not to exist. The molder. This critic tries to get you to fit into a certain mold based on standards held by society, your culture, or your family. It wants you to be liked and admired, and to protect you from being abandoned, shamed, or rejected. The molder fears that the rebel or free spirit in you would act in ways that aren't acceptable. So it keeps you from being in touch with expressing your true nature. The taskmaster. This critic wants you to work hard and be successful. It fears that you may be mediocre or lazy and will be judged a failure if it does not push you to keep going. Its pushing often activates a procrastinator or rebel that fights against its harsh diktats. And finally, the inner controller. This critic tries to control your impulses, eating, drinking, sexual activity, etc. It is polarized with an indulger, an addict who it fears can get out of control at any moment. It tends to be harsh and shaming in an effort to protect you from yourself. It is motivated to try to make you a good person who is accepted and functions well in society. So even a quick read through that short webpage is a really valuable exercise in identification that can lead to a powerful new understanding of self. Do you have one of those inner critics? Do you have 4, 5, 6, or 7 of them? A lot of that certainly resonated with me. And one of the common threads, obviously, that runs through each type of inner critic exactly lines up with the title of that episode of Reboot Your Kids. The way we are spoken to as young children by adults, especially our parents, forms a powerful inner voice inside us. So consider that a preview of an upcoming production. Think about that as you listen to my conversation with Lorette. I hope you enjoy this production. I look forward to your feedback, as always. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care. Hi, Lorette. Welcome back to the world of podcasting. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be here. It took a while, but it really does feel like a natural home to me. I enjoy it. I consider myself a professional talker, so this is where I belong, right?
Absolutely. I feel the same way about you and about me.
Yeah, I really love reconnecting with you. When I started podcasting again, I decided the first thing I want to do, I, of course, want to connect with a whole bunch of new people that I haven't spoken with before. And I do want to go out of my way to connect with people that are just interesting in some capacity and not necessarily authors or doctors or famous people, them too, of course, but anyone that's interesting. My first priority, though, was to reconnect with some of my favorites, some of the people that I always had really interesting, useful, productive conversations with, and you are in my top three of those people.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You always give great conversations, Brett, and that's what I want to deliver to my audience, and I hope that I can deliver the same quality to your audience as well.
All right. Well, I'm excited. Let's do it.
Well, the thing I'd like to start with, for the sake of my listening audience who may not be completely familiar with you, and a lot of them are because a lot of them are diehard fans of mine, but for anyone that may not be, just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I was in education for a total of about 12 years. I was a self-contained classroom special education teacher in a fairly challenging boarding school environment for my first 2 years as a teacher. From there, I moved on to teach history and mathematics at a high school level in a semi-private school in Vermont. And then from there, I spent the next 3 years working for a tutoring company in the greater Boston area, doing primarily academic tutoring, which I would describe as being a public school enforcement agent, basically extending a lot of the corrosive attitudes that exist in public schooling beyond the afternoon bell and into the home, like you must get good grades, you must go to college, I'm here because something is wrong with you. And I really didn't like that kind of tutoring, especially at the time, because I was learning more and more about the nature of schooling versus education and the history of public schooling, and realizing that I was very much a participant in that problem. Lateral to that academic tutoring, did SAT tutoring, and I wanted to focus more on that standardized test tutoring. So in 2009, I actually started a company in New Hampshire where I live, where we only did SAT or other standardized test tutoring like the ACT, all college entry exams. And I tried to make the course about opportunities that existed in preparation for that test. It's not just about getting two or three numbers that you can put on a college application. There actually are real learning opportunities in that preparation process to develop language skills, to develop persuasive writing skills, logical reasoning, vocabulary. So I try to, you know, separate myself from the very, very competitive SAT prep market by saying there are actual real learning opportunities. And I really believe that. Things that are left underdeveloped by the school, you can strengthen through this process. And while all this was going on, really since 2009, I was realizing I had more and more things that I wanted to say myself about schooling versus education. So in the year 2009, I started the School Sucks podcast, which was basically just like a therapeutic audio journal at first. It grew in size and popularity. And even though initially I thought I had a very limited number of things to say, and it would be 10, 20, maybe 30 episodes, once a community built around it and people started making suggestions about things we should cover on the show, I realized that it didn't have to end. And here I am doing it, 6 years later as my job. I haven't taken a new tutoring client since spring of last year. I actually have just started taking clients from the audience for specialized tutoring that people might want. I have my first client and I'm looking for more. So I'm getting back into tutoring now in a different way. But the School Sucks project is my career. So that worked out nicely. And it kind of validates me spending 4 years and something like $60,000 on a college degree in communications. So things are working out.
There you go. There you go. I have a similar experience. I have a degree in communication. I've never used it until the last few years. So eventually we find our purpose and we find our usefulness for our education. It's just too bad that it costs so much money. But congratulations on your success.
Thanks.
And it is actually great to hear that you are offering your expertise in tutoring. And I want to kind of punctuate this. Education versus schooling. So you're offering tutoring in what would be a reasonable education and a useful education versus schooling. Now, the reason why I'm staying on that particular phraseology is because you and I have thrown around that phrase before, and that was a platform that I took when I was doing my old podcast, which was Unplugged Mom, and I would talk about the distinction between schooling and education, because they are not synonymous and they are not two different things, which led to a lot of the decisions that I had been making in my life, realizing that as a home educating parent, I was not a homeschooling parent, but a home educating parent. And I know that we have had that discussion before. What I would like to talk to you about, since we're both fans of useful communication and we both like to infuse the concept of trivium and critical thinking into our work, is reasoning and logic and how that applies to how we communicate with children, children at different ages. You have experience as a teacher working with special needs children, working with teenagers, working with children of different ages, or let's just say youth. I don't even like to use the word children once they start to become, or once we as human beings start to become young adults. I think those terms in and of themselves create a barrier between adults and children, and this allows us from communicating, because it just establishes there's a difference between us and I'm above you, and we don't necessarily need to have that barrier because it causes problems in communication. So going along that line, I know that you and I have both spoken to Gino Denning and a few other people on the concept of trivium, and we've been students of critical thinking and logic for a few years now. The concept that sticks with me most of the time is that it's twofold. It's a learning process for everyone. Anyone at any age, the trivium applies, because that is how we learn any information. The grammar, we have grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Those are the three pillars of the trivium. And then we get into the seven liberal arts when we add a quadrivium. But just focusing on the trivium, grammar, logic, rhetoric. What this means, and anyone who is not familiar with this, please listen up and pay attention. The basic definition of this theory or this concept is, grammar is the discovery phase. That is the foundation of something. When we learn quote unquote grammar and language arts, we're learning the foundation of language. We're learning the building blocks of language. And that really is the foundation of everything that we do in our lives, because everything comes down to the way that we communicate with one another. So grammar is where we discover it, where we are introduced to the fact that it exists, and it's the basic foundation. Logic is the phase where we begin to understand it. And we understand it by comparing it to everything that we previously thought we knew, and looking for holes, looking for contrast, and looking to rectify the information so that it makes sense in a useful and productive way in our understanding. Rhetoric is the phase where we begin to repeat what we've learned and communicate it back out into the world, which also helps us understand it even better. So it's a self-feeding process. If we look at this in terms of just learning one thing, we go through that process every day of our lives. If we look at it in a lifespan, however, children and adults, human beings, let's say human beings, physiologically go through these phases. As young children, before puberty, everything is about grammar. Everything is about understanding and absorbing the world. And then in the teenage years, we've labeled that the rebellious years, but let's take a look at why it's the rebellious years. It's because human beings are in a logic phase of their life, and they are naturally supposed to be challenging everything they have previously learned and comparing it to everything they are currently learning, looking for holes, looking for things that don't make sense, looking for hypocrisy and calling it out and, you know, shouting out that's hypocritical. And trying to process that and understand it. This is the logic phase. So we're going to naturally challenge things when we're teenagers and going through puberty, because that's where our brain is at as far as the developmental process. And then as older teens and into our early 20s, we start to develop and refine our verbal and our written communication skills so that we can practice rhetoric and retell everything that we have learned and then come to understand in a way that we understood it, which also solidifies our understanding of it or can change our understanding of it once we speak it aloud, and can also help other people in their learning phase. So with that explanation in mind, something that we said a couple of minutes ago, or that I said a couple of minutes ago and you agreed with, is and I keep saying it over and over again because I'm used to it. It's infused into our society, is creating a distinction between speaking to children, speaking to teens, speaking to adults. And there is a difference, obviously, physiologically. But when we, especially taking it, you know, into the school system, which is something that your work focuses on, Brett, when we address children with that distinction of this is an adult, this adult is in charge of you, and these group of adults – are somehow in charge of your lives and education, we're actually creating a barrier in communication. So yeah. I would like to hear your thoughts on how we can more effectively communicate with young human beings that are going through these different phases of learning so that we're actually not establishing a barrier, but building more of a reciprocal bridge and how that can enhance the human experience of learning.
That is a fantastic question. And before I answer it, I want to go all the way back and get a running start, something you said several minutes ago about schooling versus education. And this is how the Trivium really came to be a part of my show. Now, for people who are new to this, which I consider the Trivium to be a more authentic and a valuable tool for a learner-driven education, a self-sufficient education where you're not relying on people to school you, you are able to make sense of the world through a method for yourself, and this can start at a very young age. I will caution people that studying the Trivium is fairly complex. There's at least three interpretations of it, the classical Trivium, grammar, logic, rhetoric, as it's usually put, the esoteric Trivium, where those three ways are understood as knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And there's even kind of a more modern version of the Trivium, which does grammar, logic, and rhetoric as input, process, and output. And I encourage people to check out the work that Gino Denning has done. I'm sure there's definitely archives of it on School Sucks Project. We did a series about it. I encourage people to check out the work of Jared Sanchez. There's another site called TriviumEducation.com that is definitely worth visiting. TragedyAndHope.com has a pretty expansive section on the Trivium, also largely based on Gino Denning's work. So there's actually even a lot of disagreement about how the Trivium should be understood, how the Trivium should be taught. So I really, really encourage people to do their own research and just take in as much as they can. And then, of course, using the Trivium, start to process and filter what you find. And
Brett, I'm going to just interrupt you for 1 second. And I know that in my interrupting you is a communication faux pas, but I want to just cement something that you just said. I have reintroducing this new podcast. One of the most recent episodes I did was with Jared Sanchez, and we did begin to have the Trivium conversation. We will have more conversations. I've had, of course, as you know, conversations with Gino Denning. So I'm on the same page as you, and I would like all of the listening audience to know that we, Brett and I, are actually come from the same quote unquote school of thought as far as Trivium. Brett is, I would say, better versed in this area than I am, but we're traveling down the same interpretation of Trivium, and I would echo all of the suggestions that Brett made.
Absolutely. And I'm about to launch back into an even deeper study of this. There's a lot of aspects of it that I really want to, you know, understand better for myself. Now, this relates to the schooling versus education question. I just want to say, recently, I have been working on writing the introduction for the new edition of The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto, and I was trying to think about my own development in coming to understand the whole schooling problem and education solution. And it was really, you know, it was one line. I was reading this article that he wrote called Against School. This was probably almost 9 or 10 years ago. And he just starts one paragraph with this simple, seemingly simple question. Do we really need schooling? I don't mean education just for schooling. And for me, in 2006 or 2007, when this occurred, that question was like a major breakthrough. And I want to credit you because it was like 6 years after that, you really encouraged me to stop using the word schooling for what goes on outside of school, either in the home or in the world. So you got me away from phrases like homeschooling, which I used all the time, and even unschooling. Right. And you
right.
said only school can do school. So stop thinking in terms of school. And that was really, yeah. really helpful for me as well.
It's all part of defining our terms.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, when it comes to this question of communicating with young people, with youth, I really believe that when you're talking about very young children, the priority should be sensitivity, understanding that tones of voice, micro expressions, all of that means a lot and goes a long way in that type of communication with very young children. And with teens, I would say that the priority really needs to be respect. Whether we're parents or teachers, our way of talking to young people is going to, especially with very young children, create in them, as they grow, powerful inner voices, you know, that are going to speak to them as well. And this is often considered or called, I think there was a psychologist named Jay Early who popularized the concept of an inner critic. Now, having some degree of inner critic, a constructive inner critic, is obviously a good thing, but having one or more inner critics that are, you know, sabotaging action or intention in life, that's something that obviously as parents or educators or mentors, we would like to avoid. So if we just want to focus on young children first, I think respect is a part of it. Talking to them like they're human beings. I mean, how many times have we heard, how many times have I done it? You know, somebody talking to a child, say under 7 years old, and they say, "Good job, good boy," like you would talk to a pet, you know. And mm-hmm. you can be enthusiastic, but also explain, you know, why you're happy with what's happening. There's a type of I think evaluative praise.
So in other words, if they like with young children especially, they're learning dexterity and they're learning basic physical functions like how to hold crayons and manipulate basic tools, which is something that I think as adults we forget is a learning process. That's why we have safety scissors for young children. But what comes to mind predominantly is when they draw a picture, and you know, no matter what the picture is of, parents will normally say, "Hey, great, good job," and sometimes go overboard. And then you have the other extreme where, you know, and I know that you and I have had these conversations with parents where they feel like, no, you should never say that and you should never praise them, and just kind of nod and acknowledge, "Yes, you drew a picture." But I think that like everything else, there is a continuum that we need to not choose one point on that continuum, but allow ourselves to flexibly slide along that continuum depending on the situation. So in other words, if you truly do believe that your child did a really good job on this drawing because they are showing that they're using their dexterity and that they're learning and that they're progressing, what you're saying is to be specific and not, even if they're just 4 or 5 years old, not just say, "Hey, great job," but to say, "Hey, those trees look really good. They look so much better than the ones you drew yesterday. You're really learning."
Yeah.
And I if that's what you're saying, then I would concur, because I think it's important that the child knows why you think they did a good job.
That is perfectly echoes something that Nathaniel Brandon said in The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem when he was talking about nurturing a child's self-esteem. State the facts and leave the evaluation to the child. Now, evaluative praise, like you mentioned, this is better than, or you have improved, I think, since what you did yesterday when you tried to do something similar. I think that's a reasonable kind of praise. And then I think there's an appreciative praise to just say, I really don't even like the word praise. I think, but most of it should focus on appreciation versus evaluation.
We say feedback.
Yeah, feedback.
Yeah, that
because
makes sense.
When you were talking about this question of overpraise versus no praise, well, I think both extremes have dangers, right? If you convey to the child your own indifference, I think that, especially with very young children, that's going to lead to a feeling of invisibility. But if you overpraise, you risk creating something that schools often create through the use of carrots, which is this type of approval addicts, people who will only feel good when, mostly feel good, I should say, when they're pleasing authorities, which is a terribly dangerous thing.
Well, this is kind of where we've come after the last 100 years of indoctrinating in this way, is that we've brought up a nation of people. And I don't want to make a sweeping generalization and just say that everybody's like this, because clearly not everybody is. However, I think there are many, many people walking around out there that have learned to earn praise so that they can please an authority figure. And that does create a very dangerous situation in a political sense, because instead of being a nation that they're teaching us in school in third grade is quote unquote for the people, by the people, we're really creating a nation that is a dictatorship, and we don't even realize it because we're taught to not only submit to obligatory authority figures, but to crave that kind of obligatory authority over us because we feel validated by some kind of authority. And I do think that there is something very Orwellian in that and very dangerous. And the unfortunate truth is that it has been going on for generations. The good news, though, is that I do think that we are beginning to recognize the detriment in that and move away from it. And I believe that it is through productive, useful, and skillful communication that we will be able to progress past that.
Yeah, I'm also really excited about this time. And before I talk about that excitement, you know, just this era that we live in, I think that one of the most important guidelines for our communication with young people is they feel visible, you know, which comes through, especially with parents, the conveyance of love and acceptance. And then maybe more for educators or mentors, it's appreciation or respect. Communicating in a way that makes young people feel visible. Because throughout most of history, and this is still a major problem today, children, as far as their needs are concerned, were very invisible. And the exciting thing about this era that certainly wasn't possible when you and I were, say, in middle school or even in high school, is that if a kid has disrespectful interactions with, you know, and I just wonder how many times this occurs in America or around the world today. They have interactions with teachers or parents where they feel minimized or disrespected, undervalued, whatever. They can be like, yeah, but I'm a YouTube star. 200,000 people love me on YouTube. So tough. You know,
I just think
like, even, you know, it even relates to the ability to like fact check your teachers with your phone in class, that now we're living in a time because of, you know, Web 2.0 and this very interactive internet, everybody can have a voice. Now, that, of course, is a double-edged sword, because we also have this idea that everybody's voice has this equal right to be heard based on how much information is powering it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also a false sense, and I'm actually going to stick to this a little bit, this topic a little bit, before we move forward, although I want to move forward.
Sure.
It can create, and having new teenagers, I'm saying new because my children are 14, 13, 11 right now, so we're just entering that what would be labeled rebellious teenager phase, and having them be infused into this world of internet. They pretty much grew up where the internet was a thing. They don't remember life without being able to communicate instantaneously with their friends. So I can concur that this is a double-edged sword. It is wonderful in many ways and very beneficial to their lives in many ways, but also very detrimental to their lives in many ways. And I have observed, among other children and among other of peers that are around their age, that it can create a false sense of validation. And when I say false sense of validation, is that typically, and we know that people go through this in their youth, and also adults go through this, when we're looking for some kind of validation for ourselves, or we're going through something that is difficult or painful, we do look for ways to make ourselves feel better, or we look for some kind of attention. And unless we've learned otherwise through our lives and through some kind of wisdom experience, we will look for any kind of attention and any kind of validation, even if it's negative. And having this kind of free access to the rest of the world and anybody in it does sometimes allow children to fall into the trap of experiencing a negative kind of attention and a negative kind of false validation, or that makes them feel legitimized in negative ways. So when you say that it's a double-edged sword, it very much is. And I think that the solution to that, and what has worked so far with my family, is just always being able to have a constant communication, a constant dialogue about it. And something that I try to infuse into my conversations with my children is being very honest with them and letting them know that I did not grow up with the internet. So when, as parents, we try to say, oh, there's nothing new, anything that you've experienced, I've experienced before, my children can legitimately say to me, no, you haven't, because right. You didn't have the internet when you were a kid. So I can honestly say to them, this is new to me too. What's not new is the basic foundation of the problem. Because, you know, we peer pressure and all of that. But what is new is the exposure to it. I was only exposed to these kind of problems and social drama and rumors and, you know, everything through my own neighborhood. And it was very controlled and very easy to forget because once it was gone, it's gone. Now, if it's out there, it's out there forever. You're branded and it's all over the internet and, you know, potentially millions of people can be exposed to it at the same time. So I will admit to my children, yes, this is new, but let's learn together. And I can use just my experience as a human being, having been on the planet for 30 years longer than you have, to try to help you navigate these potential pitfalls and dangers together so that we can enjoy the benefits of it, but also avoid anything that might hurt us. And yeah, my children have gotten into some sticky situations in online atmospheres, but it was never an issue where I had to point my finger at them and scold them and tell them how bad they were, because they knew that I was full of shit. They knew that I didn't grow up with internet. I didn't experience this. So it was a matter of, okay, we've gotten ourselves, or you've gotten yourself into trouble here. How can we work together to figure out what the solution is here and how we can move past it? And I think that's an important part of communicating with teenagers, because they're in that phase of, the world calls it rebellion, but I'm just calling it logic, because that's what they're doing. They're trying to find flaws. They're trying to find holes. They're looking for hypocrisy without even knowing that they are, and they're challenging everything in a very natural way. So it does help as a parent or as a teacher or as anyone that is in a position of leadership where they're trying to help children thrive, to speak to them, like you said, with respect, and speak to them and address them like they're not invisible, because they're not, and just be honest and say, okay, let's figure this out together.
Yeah, absolutely. That is such a breath of fresh air to hear that story, comparing it to my experience, the way I remember being treated as a young person, the way I've observed young children being treated in my family today, the kinds of interactions that I saw working in school or working as a school support person. There is, even if it's subtle, it is so persistent, this talking down tone to not just very young children, where it is very, very clear to hear all too often, but also teenagers, right? Being spoken down to, and very, very little humility or empathy coming from adults, especially in those school settings, like, oh, yeah, I don't know either. You know, you just, mm-hmm. you don't hear that. And sometimes it's very explicit. Sometimes it's very subtle. But in the school environment, it is terribly, terribly relentless. That is what mm-hmm. that milieu is all about, is that kind of power over dynamic. And this speaks to the whole teenage rebellion thing. I don't see it obviously as a problem. Obviously, there are dangers with a kind of guidance-less teenage rebellion, but I see it as a positive thing. And you know, a lot of people say, oh, this is what teenagers do. Is it really? Like, this is what sharks do. This is what parrots do. You know, why? There's a reason why they do it. And I think part of it, simply put, even though there's a far more in-depth psychological evaluation available, it's like they're big enough to run away from bullshit, you know? And now, as they go from that gathering up information and being able to identify things in their surroundings, moving into more of a logic phase, it's like, school? Really? Are you kidding me? These rules? Why? You know, and even if, you know, some of the things that they're challenging might make sense because they were put in place as a result of the wisdom of others, that is often not the case, you know,
especially. No, it is often not the case.
Right.
And if it is, Brett, all it takes is a conversation and a respectful dialogue to kind of explain it. And a lot of times, rules and regulations that were put in place by a wisdom of those that came before us, sometimes they change as times change, and we need to always remain flexible about that. And yeah, this is what children, like you, I want to go back to what you said, because I think it was brilliant and profound. This is what children do, but what, like sharks do, like parrots do. Let's ask ourselves why. Why is this what children do? And I think the answer to that is because it's physiologically natural for a human being, when they're going through puberty and when their hormones are changing and when their brain is expanding and their intellect is expanding, to start to challenge everything that they're observing in the world and say, why? Why these rules? Why this atmosphere? Why is it that something I thought that was true when I was 10 isn't true anymore? Why am I experiencing this? Now, we're seeing this as rebellion, because I think as adults that have been through this standardized process ourselves, we're inept at truly seeing beneath the surface of the situation, and we feel insecure and we feel challenged. We're egocentric creatures. We don't like when our ego is challenged. So when our ego gets challenged by somebody that's 20 years or 15 years younger than us, our guard goes up to protect our ego, and we say, just shut up and do what you're told. And then the teenager is saying, well, fuck you.
Yeah.
I don't want to shut up and do what I'm told. But you know what, Brett? It is natural for them to say, fuck you. They're supposed to. They're supposed to challenge it. So how do you deal with that as someone that's in a leadership position or as a parent? Don't say, shut up and do what you're told. Explain your reasoning and explain, you know, I've learned this, and my understanding of this is that if you take these steps, the results are going to be negative for you. So let's talk about making a different path or cutting a different path. I think just a dialogue. It's worked for me so far in my household. I can't say that things have been perfect, but when I'm able to get over my ego and just have the conversation and not feel like, oh my God, my kid is challenging me. How dare they? Mm-hmm. How do they know? What do they know? They didn't live the life that I lived. They're not trying to challenge my ego. They're not trying to hurt me. They're trying to grow. They're trying to learn. So just having the conversation and the open, respectful dialogue goes a lot more smoothly. And it ends up where the child will listen to you, or the young adult will listen to you and say, okay, that makes sense. And then leave it to them to make the decision.
Yeah. You know, you use the word natural, and I'm interested if the way things have worked with adult treatment of children for so long, it seems like, you know, a young person gets to the age of 15 or 16 and they naturally enter this rebellious phase. But is that actually more artificial? And I don't know the answer. I'm interested to hear your thoughts. And I know the way that you've done parenting is atypical, certainly in this culture. And even though your children may still be a little bit too young to really be in the heart of that rebellious phase, if children were educated or educating themselves or parented in a way where their curiosity was maintained and fostered instead of crushed by a top-down power structure like school is, would that still happen? If curiosity was always on the table, if, you know, these questions that they develop could always be chased through their own volition, through their own actions, would they, when they get to this age where they start to feel like adults, feel this impetus to push back? I don't know. I almost don't think so.
I think that the conundrum in that answer is that the only way for us to get a scientific, finite answer is by doing an actual scientific study. And if we did that, we would be putting the young adults into a controlled environment, and we wouldn't get a natural answer anyway. We wouldn't get an organic result anyway. So I think all we can really do is ponder that and discuss it based on our own experience and observation. As a parent whose children until now have not been in traditional school, I've always been an advocate for independent education. I have not used traditional school situations with my children, and I'm immersed in an environment, in a community where we have access to and are friends with many other parents that are not using school or are home educating parents in all different ways. Some of them very formal, some of them very informal. And based on my observations, Brett, and I'm saying in my physical community here where I live, and also the community at large, because as you know, I've had a vastly huge connection to the community of home educators mm-hmm. out there in the world through the internet, of course. And in my observations with these, I want to say probably thousands of other families, it does happen, of course. Children will enter this phase of rebellion, but it is almost 99% of the time more mild and manageable when they are not in an indoctrinated situation, and also when the parenting is such that there is open dialogue and open communication. And I'm not talking about this like extreme unparenting kind of thing that you would see on these on these shows on sensational TV. I'm just talking about basically being respectful and not having this system of arbitrary authority in your house where you're condescending constantly or talking down to children. Of course, none of us are perfect parents. We were all brought up in a screwed up world, so we're going to be screwed up sometimes. We just have to notice when we're doing it. So in my own house, my children aren't 15 yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do know that they're beginning to enter the phase where they are challenging everything that they've previously learned. And for us, I handle it more smoothly than I see other families handle it. Of course, we do have friends whose children go to school, and I do notice a significant contrast in the way those teenagers are processing these years compared to the way that children who don't experience the crushing indoctrination of typical schooling deal with it. And I do think that you're correct. It does have a lot to do with the fact that they are in an environment where they feel suffocated. They feel crushed. They feel like when they're going through this natural intellectual phase of challenging the world and the way they perceive the world, they're trying to understand it. They're in an environment that is trying to subdue that, crush it, and tell them just sit down and do what you're told. They're in an environment that is constantly condescending them, that is constantly making them feel invisible. You're just a number. You're not worthy. You didn't make the grade. You cannot speak because what you have to say isn't worthy. Anything. And then, you know, they're also in an environment where they're told anytime they do challenge something, oh, you're just being a rebellious teenager. Oh, you're just trying to give me a hard time. Oh, I can't stand it. I can't wait till my kids are out of this teenage phase. So they're constantly being told how screwed up they are. So, of course, they're going to behave in a screwed up fashion. You put a dog in a cage and you beat him, you know, he's going to act wild. That's just how it is. When you have children that are not in that environment and are a little bit more free to express themselves and engage in dialogue, then that challenging phase in life, yes, it is natural because it's physiological, but it manifests in a much healthier way and more mildly and so much more smoothly. And if we go back through history, we may find reading historical texts that all throughout history, when young adults came, they would call it like becoming a woman or becoming a man. And there was always this phase where they would talk to their elders and be like, I'm ready to go to war, or, you know, I'm ready to be the man of the house, or, you know, a woman would be like, I'm ready to take on these new responsibilities. And the elders, either in their family or the community, and we hear stories about this in parables where they would say, well, you must first learn these things. They're having dialogue and they're not in this enforced environment. So it is natural for teenagers to go through this, but it's unnatural for them to go through it in an enclosed, fabricated, artificial environment. So yes, I believe that you're right. I don't think that we could ever prove it scientifically, because doing a scientific study would completely negate the whole point of it. But just through observation, yes, I agree with you. I think you're right. It has everything to do with being forced into an artificial situation. It's so much more mild outside of that, and smoother and healthier.
Yeah. And when that artificial situation is imposed, it makes sense that a day will come when a boy or a girl, you know, reaches an age where they say, okay, I think I'm strong enough and potentially self-sufficient enough. It is time to get my need for respect met, because it never has been, or at least not consistently, or at least there's been sufficient interruptions that have, you know, left a longing for that respect, especially from, you know, the just this environment that's set up where they're always trying to please these people. So, yeah. All right. I'm very satisfied with your answer. I totally agree.
I want to punctuate that. I just want to give you a little anecdotal story.
And
this is multi-layer true story. I think I've talked about this before. My children are theater kids, and they, over the last few years, even though I haven't been very, very in the media myself, my children have continued to thrive in their theater lives and become wonderful young performers. My younger two sons right now are in a production called Nanyahi, and my middle son was in it last year. Nanyahi is the true story of Nancy Ward. Her a Native American name is Nanyahi, and she was instrumental in the whole Trail of Tears and that era. Anyway, the story is between her and her cousin. Her cousin, and again, this is a true story. The musical is based on a true story. Her cousin, the name of her cousin is Young, Dragon Canoe. My son plays Young Dragon Canoe. There's a whole other story after that is actually a very interesting story about Nanyahi herself, But I want to focus on the story of his cousin, Dragon Canoe, is that when he was young, he went through that, like you're saying. He said, American Indian, Native Americans were going to war between the tribes. And he said to his elders, I'm ready to go to war. And the elders said, no, you're not, you're too young. And he said, no, I'm not, I'm ready. It doesn't matter how old I am. I'm ready, I'm strong, I'm powerful, I'm fierce. So the elder said to him, if you can take this canoe and drag it all the way to the river, then you're strong enough to go to war. And he did it. And of course, he was strong enough to go to war. And he became one of the youngest warriors that particular tribe ever experienced. And I think that story relates to what we're saying, because it was something that in today's culture, if a child of 10 or 11 or 12 years old came to us and said, well, I'm ready to perform this task, whether it was in school or a typical environment, they would say, I'm ready to do this task, which is normally an adult task. We would automatically say, no, you're too young, and maybe not even give them the opportunity to say, okay, well, let me see if you can safely perform this task. And if you can, then yes, you're ready, period, end of story. We would just look at them arbitrarily by their age and say, no, you're not ready. So let's relate it to maybe not to war, because it's a whole other conversation we can have.
Sure, yeah.
But let's really, that's different. We're talking about violence there. But let's relate it to a 10-year-old saying, I'm very intelligent and I understand this and I don't want to go through middle school. I want to skip right to my college education. That does happen, far and few between, but most of the time, the typical indoctrinated system will tell them, nope, shut up, do what you're told, and conform. And this is unfortunate, because this is detrimental to children or teenagers that say, I'm ready to take on these new responsibilities. And as a society, we're telling them, no, you have to go through the motions and finish high school and go through these steps that we've prepared for you because we think this is the right way. It can be suffocating to a human being. And then those human beings become adults and repeat the process over and over again.
It was done to me. It must be done to you. Right?
Right.
You
exactly.
can't escape
exactly.
it. What does it say about me? If you escape it, what does it say about me as a parent or a teacher or an authority figure if you don't have to follow the rules that I followed? You know, you said something a minute ago about, you know, we all came from screwed up places as far as how we were raised. Absolutely. You know,
yeah.
And I think that, you know, I'm 38 years old. I don't have any children of my own. I'm not opposed to the idea. I've honestly just never felt ready to do it. And I think the more I've learned in the last 10 or 12 years and really trial by fire at one point, working with young people who had traumatic pasts in very high stress and often authoritarian environments, it gave me a lot of pause. And I think that if people, not everybody does, and it's okay, and it's certainly, you know, not the end of the world if things don't happen this way, but I feel like I've had the luxury to engage in this process of reparenting myself, you know, which is ongoing, and I'm still doing. We think so much about the horror and the fear that appears in these adults when they have to deal with certain types of behavior from their children, and whether it's teachers or parents, so much of it translates to like I'm going to be judged as bad because of your behavior, you know, and it really shows this the way that trauma can be transferred from one generation to another. It's like they have their own inner critics that are still very much with them as adults. It's like, you're going to be bad. People are looking at you in the store. Oh my goodness. You know, that kind of a thing. So they're basically talking to children in a disrespectful manner that is going to manifest a new set of inner critics. And I think that mm-hmm. I'm not opposed to the idea of having children. I think there's a series of questions that I would want to have answered, you know, and where I would want to feel comfortable before I did. And, you know, the first one would be something like, what is a peaceful and respectful parent? Did I have them? And, you know, if the answer to that question is no, my parents, both of them, considering where each of them came from, did a much better job with me and my brothers than their parents did with them. But by my standards today, based on the data that I've gathered, did I have peaceful and respectful parents? By and large, no. So if the answer to that question is no, then what are the wounds from that? And how are they healed? And then are they healed? And when the answer to that last question is yes, I think I would be in the best position to work with young people as a mentor and be as effective as possible. But I also think that's when I would be ready as a parent. And some people might be ready before that because their wounds could be smaller, you know, than somebody else's. So obviously, this isn't any kind of a judgment against anybody who had children before all of those questions were answered a certain way. It's just for me, I feel that's really important because I feel like based on, you know, my family history and some of the issues that I've had, I would really, really want to have myself effectively reparented before I became a parent.
I am going to respond to you in a way that may not be the most agreeable, but I'll explain it as I go on.
Sure.
I think you're overthinking it, honestly. I really think you're overthinking it. I not that I don't think there is some value in making these considerations before you bring a human life into your experience. However, I will tell you this, and I think that a lot of parents out there, no matter where they are on the parenting spectrum, can concur. No matter how much you think you're ready to become a parent, you never are actually ready.
Right.
It's not realistic. And you don't really understand that until that human life is completely within your responsibility and you think, oh shit. Like, what have I done? And that happens to everybody, to every parent. And a lot of us try to talk ourselves out of that and say, no, I'm in it. If you go into it thinking, I'm 100% ready, all of my wounds are healed, I have all my questions answered, I'm good, I'm ready to go, you're going to be a very bad parent because you're walking into it with this arrogant sense of, I know what I'm doing, and you don't.
Absolutely.
No matter how many books you've read, no matter how much experience you think you've had, you don't know what you're doing until you're doing it. Parenting is a very much learn-as-you-go process. I think what the problem that parents run into when we do create these problematic situations in our family dynamic is because we do walk into it with this arrogant sense of, I've been there, I've done that, I know all the answers. You have to realize that you don't. You have to realize that even though you think all your wounds are healed or not, I will say that I had no idea that I even had any wounds that would need to be healed as I became a parent. I knew that there were going to be trials and I knew that there were going to be some issues. It wasn't until my kids started growing up and going through some things that triggered memories from my own past that I realized, oh my gosh, I'm not over this yet. But it took a conscious effort on my part to realize the reason why I was being so aggressive toward my child at this particular moment wasn't because of their behavior now. It was because of some shit that it was digging up from me and my past and my environment that I haven't completely dealt with yet. But I didn't know that going in. What I think my advantage was, Brett, is that I do happen to be a person that values communication always. I was always like that. And I do happen to be a person that I am an arrogant person. I'm a conceited person. But the good news about that is that I've embraced it. I know that I have an ego, and that means that I can get over it when I feel like I need to get over it, remove myself from the situation, go back to my child at some point when I've calmed down and said, look, the issue that you're involved in right now is not good, but it's not as bad as I made it out to be, and here's why. I have been accused of being a little bit overprotective, and I've had to learn to deal with that and back off of it and realize that I grew up in a concrete jungle in a very dangerous neighborhood. I got into a lot of trouble, and my 14-year-old, quote-unquote, challenging daughter will oftentimes say to me, but you're okay. You turned out okay. And my answer is always, yeah, by the grace of God. I don't know how I'm alive today. So we're not going to put you in the same kind of train wreck and just hope that you turn out okay like I did. But I also had to back up a little bit and say, well, wait a minute. I had something to do with it anyway. I have a child here that is responsible, mature, well-educated. She makes very good decisions. She has proven over and over again that she's made very healthy decisions. Why am I having a problem with this particular activity that she wants to engage in? I need to back off here and realize that we're not in the same environment. We are not growing up in the same community. She has proven that she can make responsible, healthy decisions. I have to let go. And that lends to this helicopter parenting. I'm definitely not what would be considered a helicopter parent. However, I did have to kind of reevaluate my stance. that's where you might run into trouble as a parent, Brett. Not having the children, it's not going to be a matter of being ready. It's not going to be a matter of healing your own wounds, because even if you think they're healed, they're not. When you see your child go through something that you went through or some similar event that you went through, even if it's only remotely similar, you're going to start to feel angry. You're going to start to feel hurt, and your instinct will kick in, and you'll want to protect your child from that, even if the circumstances are completely different. And that will make you realize, oh, shit, I'm really not over this. I thought I was, and I'm not, because now I'm projecting it onto my own child. The advantage that you will have as a parent, Brett, is the same advantage I have. You're smart, you're a thinker, you know how to communicate, and you can get into a situation where you feel like, okay, I messed this up, but I can admit it, I can own it, and I can fix it. Let's sit down and have a conversation. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Gosh, I'm so glad I raised these questions with you, mother of three with 14 years experience. That really, really helps. I think I would stick with the question, what is a peaceful and respectful parent? And I would want to be sure that I was on the healing path, which I am. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Nothing can prepare you for those challenges. I guess I would have to already be on the other side of that experience to really, really know that. You know, one of the themes on my show, and I think it relates to this, and it's kind of like the official quote of School Sucks podcast is by Viktor Frankl. A painting now hangs in my studio memorializing this quote, between stimulus and response. You know that quote for sure, right? Mm-hmm. And what are the methods that we can use to widen that space? And one of the most powerful and important practices or set of practices that we dealt with in the last couple years was Nathaniel Brandon's Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. And self-esteem is kind of this hokey, warm and fuzzy, you know, concept, especially how it's portrayed to people. And it's portrayed, I think, in a really corrosive way to young people. You have self-esteem when you please authorities. But in actuality, thinking about your value and your opinion of yourself as a set of practices, and a set of practices that can help widen that space between some really challenging or upsetting stimuli and responding to it instead of reacting. That process of living consciously, which I think is really what I was getting at with that first question, understanding what I'd be trying to do as a parent and what the challenges to doing that would be. The confrontation of fears and whatever, you know, unresolved pain that I have. But you brought up something that I think is really, really important and also relates to that, and it's self-acceptance. You know, like when I first raised those questions to you, like this is the criteria that I have to meet to be a parent. There's not a lot of self-acceptance conveyed in that plan, mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
And just being able to make real to myself, you know, what's going on in my head, what messes up my equilibrium, and understanding that's part of life, but then taking the responsibility to face it, you know, and not say, oh, this is a problem that is solved. This is a challenge that is ongoing that I'm determined to work on, is really, really important as well. So thank you.
I really
appreciate that.
You're not going to solve it in advance. And if you think you have, then you're in trouble. You have to go into it realizing this is going to be an adventure. It's going to be a journey. There are going to be pitfalls. There are going to be times where I'm going to mess up. And there are going to be times where I'm going to learn from those mess ups. When you walk into it thinking, I've got this, you're setting yourself up for doom. And
yes.
It's not going to go well. But, you know, Brett, I mean, this is something that human beings have been doing since the beginning of time, is procreating. And a lot of us screw it up, and there are a lot of screwed up people in the world, but a lot of us do it really well.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's just something that you really need to just jump into with both feet. I think the biggest thing is just love your children, accept who they are as individuals. And that, I want to say with a grain of salt, because that is something that is difficult for human beings to do, is accept that a human being that we love so very much and that we feel responsible for until they're adults is someone different than we are. And that it's a constant thing. It's a constant thing for me to realize that the path that they choose, that my children choose, are not my path. If they're making a decision that, even in my ultimate wisdom, knowing that, oh God, this is not going to go well, I have to let them make that decision. I mean, even when it comes down to who they're going to date and me saying, my gosh, but this guy's so much better. Why are you choosing this other one? You know, they have to make the choice. As long as it's not a dangerous choice, obviously, I'm going to have to put my foot down. They want to make a dangerous choice, but they haven't really come to me with any. They've always come to me and said, well, here's the issue. If they know that a situation is really hazardous or dangerous or not right for them, they pretty much have already made that decision. They're just looking to talk it out with me.
Yeah.
I know that we're going to have to wrap this up soon because we've gone very long, but I love speaking to you. I want to just mention two things, and then I'll give you the opportunity to close this out. The first thing is I want to talk about peaceful parenting. I don't like that term. Maybe the reason I don't like it is because it sets us up to have to live up to a particular standard. We define the word peaceful in a certain way, and anything that we do as parents that doesn't fall into that definition, we start to feel like we failed. And I think that's very dangerous, because I think there is a lot more benefit and just accepting who you are as a person. I was raised in Brooklyn, New York. I am a loud person. I am 5 feet tall, which means that I have had to learn how to be very loud in order to be heard in my indoctrinated environment. I had to learn to be tough in order to survive. I am also Italian, which makes me very naturally loud and aggressive. There is nothing peaceful about my personality. So yep. If I try to fit myself into this crunchy mama mold where, you know, I'm just going to be very soft-spoken and easy, it's not who I am. But I'm still able to have a very peaceful and respectful relationship with my children because I'm authentically who I am and I allow them to be authentically who they are. And I think that's the most important thing, is to be loving, authentic, and respectful. Based on all of this, and I know that this is going to be especially interesting to you, and then you can go ahead and pummel me with questions about that. All of the conversation that we've had, all of the conversations that we've had previously that I'm going to say at least 30% of our listening audience has heard our previous conversations, may be shocked to find out that my older two children are in school.
Yes.
And I said school. I didn't say education. I said school, didn't I?
You did, yes. There, yes, and I know
the
distinction.
Are you dying to ask me about that?
I am. I just want to say thank you for what you just said. I think that's really important. And I think if things are presented, you know, whether it's the concept of peaceful parenting or nonviolent communication with this pristineness, a lot of people would be reluctant to even try, you know, especially if they know they're still dealing with a number of their own internal challenges. I think what you said is really important. The label is kind of like a shorthand for a different way to think about the processing or the process, especially compared to the experience a lot of us might have had with our parents, or what we know about our parents' experience with our grandparents as, I don't even want to say a new standard, but a new way. And what you said is great. Yeah, it's about respect, appreciation, communicating in a way that leads to kids feeling visible, feeling self-sufficient, feeling loved. And that's all it needs to be. The peaceful comes with this clean, however you want to picture it. I understand who you are because my family is filled with people like the one you described in yourself, right? People who came from the city, people who are Italians, people who are incredibly loud, seemingly for no reason sometimes. Yeah, those are the kinds of people that I grew up around. You know, I do remember bringing a girl that I was dating, and she was from the South, to like a family outing. And she said something like, everybody seems so mad at each other, which I thought was interesting, which is funny because now you live in Oklahoma, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you grew up in Brooklyn.
It's a much different environment. Yes,
right. A slower, maybe more quiet and polite kind of culture there. So, I'm aware of that. But just because, of who we are, that doesn't mean we still can't be, you know, respectful to children. And, you know, I definitely appreciate the way that you said that. Now, your children go to a charter school. I would be interested in how that came to be, how that decision was made.
All right. Well, let me first make the distinction. Yes, it is a charter school. It is a virtual charter school.
Okay.
So everybody can just calm down. Here is how it came to be. And it was a humbling experience for me. And this is another one of those parenting ego moments that we have to realize, okay, I need to step back from this and look at the landscape for what it actually is and not what I'm perceiving it to be. And it's just one of those learning moments for me. I Everybody's heard the story before, but I'll truncate it. I chose to home educate my children without school when my daughter was 3 years old. We were still living in New York at the time, and the compulsory age, the legal compulsory age is 6, but the compulsory age really is 4. Everybody sends their children to school at 4 years old. So when she was 3 and it was spring, she was going on 4 the following August. Of course, the pressure was on to get her into school. The public school in the district where we lived, I wasn't happy with, because I immediately sat down and started asking questions about the curriculum. And my first red flag was that the administrator got annoyed with me for even asking questions. Then got further annoyed with me because I had the audacity to teach my daughter basic reading and how to count. And now she would have a problem conforming with the other children in pre-K. My second red flag was the word conform. I didn't like that, so I tried to look for other ways. At that time, the private schools were a little bit out of our league, and the only school I liked was the Montessori school, but it only went up to second grade. So I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. Nobody homeschooled in New York. It wasn't until someone had introduced the idea to me. I saw a magazine article, yada, yada, yada. I ended up home educating. We moved here to Tulsa. There were other reasons that we chose to move away from the New York area and into the Southwest, but among those reasons, the reason I chose Tulsa specifically is because there is a huge home educating community here. So I knew that it would be more comfortable for my children to be someplace where they didn't have to feel like they were constantly explaining why they didn't go to school. And that's how it's been. It's been a very beneficial, positive experience for anyone that isn't using traditional school. Now, knowing a little bit about how I parent, and I've talked about it, knowing that I'm also not perfect, It was sometime last year that my daughter came to me and said, so would I be a freshman right now? And I said, well, actually, that would be next year. But in Oklahoma, the ages are a little bit different for school. So a lot of the kids at her age are in school are actually in eighth grade and still in middle school. Some of them are in high school, though, and would be a freshman. I said, according to where you're at, yeah, probably. So she said, well, I want to go to college. And I'm always of the mind that, you know what, this is a very expensive deal. A lot of people waste a lot of money on this endeavor.
Amen.
Why? What do you want to go to college for? Well, she gave me this whole plan that she had laid out. She's a theater kid. She's very serious about making a career in theater, not film, not TV, but theater. And she decided that she wants to go to one of the local colleges here and get her bachelor's degree in theater arts and then go to Tisch in Manhattan. So, you know, of course, moving out of New York, the joke is on me, and pursue her master's in theater because she would like to have a career in theater. So I said, okay. Now, I know that in order to have a career in theater, you don't necessarily need a theater degree, but she gave me a very well-presented conversation, and she gave me a lot of information about the study and the research that she's done and the people that she wants to emulate, or the people that she respects in the industry, in the theater industry, and exemplified the training that they had and the path that they took, and she would like to take a similar path. But she also presented me with the explanation that she would like to earn a scholarship to some of these schools. And I said, you know, you're making a very good point, and I can't be anything but proud of you for the presentation that you're giving me. Let's talk about it a little bit more. Let's see what we're going to do. I said, you can still get into college when you're homeschooled. That's fine. And she said, well, I would like to expand my horizons beyond what I'm experiencing now. I said, what do you mean? So she said, well, I don't think that public school is a very healthy environment. I don't think I'm going to learn anything, but I would like to have the opportunity to receive an education outside of what we're doing. In other words, I want to take some online courses. And I said, okay. So my initial response to that, Brett, and I didn't say this out loud, but in my head, the alarms were going off, and I was saying, what, I'm not good enough for you anymore? You don't think I can do this? What, you don't think I'm doing
sure.
a good job?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was my initial, like, huh, well, I've dedicated my life to this, and now suddenly it just doesn't work for you anymore. That was what I was experiencing inside of me,
right.
You know, and also knowing that she was getting to a point where academically it was becoming a little bit challenging for me because I found myself having this account on Khan Academy trying to relearn all the math so I can help her learn it. And it was becoming a little bit of a struggle for her because she was realizing the hypocrisy in me and really not wanting to hurt my feelings, but saying, well, what is the point of me going through these motions if you don't even remember this? And I was thinking, well, it kind of is pointless. So what do I do here? Do I say, okay, let's forget about algebra? But then she was coming and saying, no, I want to learn this, but you're not equipped, Mom. And you just have to realize that I want other options. So the first question was, can I get a tutor? And it was, you know, one of those humbling experiences for me again. And I said, but okay, this is the path you want to take. Anyway, long story short, she ended up going online and looking at some of the private virtual schools that are available. While some of them were great, especially the Waldorf one, mm-hmm. I thought was fantastic. I thought it was a little pricey. And I said, I don't know if it's really worth this much money. K-12 sucked. K-12 was really just an online version of Common Core at home.
We did kind of
experiment with it a little bit, and it just didn't end up being good for us. We ended up using a virtual charter school that is exclusive to Oklahoma that offers, I think, 12 different options in curriculum, and you do have access to a one-on-one teacher in person. After having spoken with the counselors at the school, they assigned me to a teacher who herself is a homeschooling parent and, well, home educating parent, and intends to enroll her son when he gets close to high school. She understood exactly where I was coming from. We had a great conversation. She had a great conversation with the kids. It's my older two, because this kind of ended up where the conversation bled over into my son that's just 1 year younger than my daughter. So he decided that he wanted to start going this route as well. And she just had this great conversation with them. She was very respectful toward them. They expressed some of their concerns and their objectives for continuing their education. And she said, well, let's meet those needs. Let's meet them in your way, though. So let's pick out the path for you that is going to work for you instead of these other cheesy curriculums that may not work for you. She also let them know that she herself is not really a fan of standardized testing, but because we are going this route, it's something that they might have to do. And surprisingly, Brett, they said, yeah, that's fine. I'm okay with that. And I said, really? Because we've never tested before in our house. We didn't do that. We didn't keep grades. And they said, no. And my son explained to me, he said, this is not intimidating to me because I understand that it doesn't mean anything besides how well I'm absorbing that information, and it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm cool with it. I'm not nervous about it. I know it doesn't. It was that moment, Brett, that I was able to get over myself and get over my ego, and all of my anxieties melted away because I looked at them and I smiled and I said, wow, I did a really good freaking job.
Yeah.
Here they are coming to me and telling me I'm ready. I'm ready to move beyond the horizons, expand and work with other people and learn from other professors and take these courses online. And what I love about the courses online is that they can complete their education on their time. They can work at 2 o'clock in the morning if they want. They have access to have conversations. So, like, in other words, my son is in his math course, he's supposed to score a 95 before he can move on to the next assignment. And he scored a 92, and he spoke to the teacher and said, I understand. I don't want to have to retake this whole thing. I understand the concept. Here's why I got this particular question incorrect. They had the conversation. She said, great, you're exempt. Let's move on. And I said, this is great. This is exactly how I would be doing it, only it's beyond the confines of me, let's say. You know? That's when I started to realize I did what I needed to do. I've accomplished it. And instead of being 18 and on their own and pursuing the rest of their education themselves, they're 13 and 14. So heck yeah, I did a great job.
I don't know why anyone in either of our audiences would think this is anything but a beautiful story, you know, especially with your daughter who kind of pioneered this effort. She had a clear understanding of what she wanted and figured out what the path was to get there. And that's beautiful.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
That
and it
is
goes
educational.
Back to the story we were saying before, where a child at a certain age comes and says, I'm ready for this. And by their age, we just arbitrarily say, no, you're not. Sit down and shut up. I could have done that. I could have said, no, you have to wait until you're 17. Why? I don't know. But they came to me earlier than that. She kind of initiated it, and they're best friends, the two of them. So they talked about it and said, yeah, this is a good idea. We're ready for this. And I said, okay, let's do it. But I have to get over myself. I have to get over my ego.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That is educational self-sufficiency at its finest on their part, I think. That's wonderful.
Good. I'm glad to hear you feel that way, because another thing about parenting is every once in a while we need some other friend to tell us and put a hand on our shoulder and say, you did okay.
Well, I even think that if, you know, like I have a friend who's as much of a critic of the schools as I am. Her daughter is like probably 15 or 16 and goes to a pretty competitive public school because she wanted to after being home educated. And I think that, you know, as long as the intellectual and emotional self-defenses are in place, and I was in that situation as a parent, and a kid said that to me, like, hey, yeah, you know, I might like to go to public school for a year. I'd be like, yeah, that'd be pretty funny. You know, I mean,
right.
That might be hilarious, that we'll get some good stories from that to tell our friends. I think that's fine as long as they're prepared to deal with whatever those challenges are. But I think that the bigger picture here is a self-awareness that includes long-term goals and an understanding of how those goals are met, and you know, a willingness and an intrinsic motivation to walk that path to get there. I mean, this is what it's all about. And just because we're talking about self-education, that doesn't mean that along the way there isn't going to be a need for mentors or teachers or professional training. I think, of course, there is.
They're tapping their resources.
Exactly.
They're recognizing the resources that are available to them, and they're tapping those resources. And it goes back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, where we're not trying to please an authority figure. We're not performing to please the authority. We're performing to please ourselves and to enrich our own lives. And I think that distinction right there makes all the difference.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I like that story, Laurette, a lot.
Good. I'm glad. You know, I had such a great time talking with you again. I'm really thrilled because every time I talk with you, we have such enriching conversations. They're useful to me. I hope that they're useful to you.
Absolutely.
I think that they're useful to our listening audiences, and I hope that we can connect again and again, just like old times.
Indeed. I really look forward to that. I did have something in show prep that we didn't get to, and I just wanted to plug it for your audience. And these are two potential great future guests for you. A friend of mine, his name is Kevin Geary. He does something called the Powerful Parenting Podcast. He recently had on as a guest my friend Wes Bertrand, whose work you might be familiar with. He runs the Complete Liberty website, and he also recently wrote a very powerful book called Complete Liberty Inside Out. And they had this conversation about the way children are spoken to and how that becomes the child's inner voice. And I took a lot of notes. It just after you wrote to me and asked to have this conversation, I was fortunate enough that it was the next show in my podcast queue on my phone. And I really recommend that people check it out. It's a long show, and take it in parts if you need to. I think Kevin even advises that at the beginning. But a lot of good information on this topic of communicating with children. I'm looking at pages of notes we didn't get to, but I think recommending it to those who are interested and motivated, it is just as effective here.
Well, let's make it a solid intention then to have a second conversation, because I think that it's worthy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And maybe we can get into more of that stuff then.
Okay, great. Well, this is Laurette Lynn. And for those that are listening on both ends, that was Brett from School Sucks Project. And Brett, just give us real quick your website.
Sure. My website is schoolsucksproject.com. And we also have a YouTube channel. The username is School Sucks Podcast.
Okay. And this is Laurette Lynn. You can learn more about me at laurettelynn.com. The podcast recordings are available there, as well as other useful information. And of course, I'm listing these on SoundCloud as well. If you have any questions, either of us would be delighted to hear from you. And we are both very responsive and interactive because we appreciate and value communication. Thanks again, Brett, and bye-bye.
Thank you. Hey, everybody, one final thing before we wrap up today. And I'm sorry, there's some guy outside with a leaf blower. I mean, come on. Excuse me, sir. Do you really think you can win against nature? I don't even know if he heard me over the leaf blower. It's pretty loud. I mean, you can probably hear it. Anyway, I just wanted to do a little announcement here at the end of the show. I recently got back into tutoring. I find this to be a fun and rewarding experience for everybody involved. I don't think the other people involved in what I'm currently doing would mind me saying so. So a little over a month ago, I was contacted by a listener who thought, you know, based on his experience listening to School Sucks Podcast and knowing me a little bit, that I could help him address some challenges and meet some goals that he had in his own life. And I would really like to expand, starting with people in the School Sucks audience.
there are, I mean, if you listen to the show, you know my areas of expertise. You know the kind of work that I've done in the past. If you want to learn a little bit more, you can go to schoolsucksproject.com. And in the main nav bar there, right all the way on the left, there's a tab that says new. Start here. So you click that. And right at the top, there's a little bio. And there's a link to my resume. And you can read it if you want. So how do you contact me? Well, next to the new start here tab, there is another drop-down menu. And it's called community. And once that opens, you'll see Contact Brett. That's the best way to get in touch with me. You can also write to me on Facebook. Let's talk. You know, if you have something you think I can help you with, if you have a home-educated child that you'd like some supplemental services for, let's explore the possibility of us working together. I'm really interested in hearing what the educational needs and desires are of the people in this audience. So let's talk. I look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.